Okay, I thought I'd take this opportunity to add a little more to what we said last week. We were speaking about the that the Torah recognizes as its greatest enemy is the religious instinct, the unbridled religious instinct of man, as if in his desire for an exclusive relationship with God of his own imagining. The Torah places a serious penalty on those who sacrifice outside of the prescribed area of the temple. I'd like to just show, you know, when you find a theme in the Torah, it's a basic theme. It appears in many places. And in last week's reading, the reading on the Sabbath last week, the reading contains a very interesting area. And that's the area of the bringing of the first fruits in Deuteronomy 26. So the Torah describes very clearly when you come to the land, 26:1, that God, your God, gives you, and you inherit it, and you dwell in it. Then you must take from the first fruits of the land that God has given you. Put these fruits in the basket, and you should go to the place that God will choose. The Torah doesn't say where it is at that time, but he will choose a place that his name resides there, and that place, of course, is the temple in Jerusalem. Now, the interesting thing about this is the first fruit, the details of the first fruits, how much you have to bring, and actually, it's a small amount. It's no amount from the Torah, the smallest amount. But you must take this fruit, and you must bring it, put it in, and you must bring it to Jerusalem. And then it says in verse 3, and this is the verse I want you to concentrate on, because there is something strange, very strange in this verse. And I want you to be able to select it, to tell me exactly what is strange in the verse. Okay, that's Deuteronomy 26:3. It says, "And you shall come to the priest that will be in those days," meaning in your days, the days that, whatever days they may be. "And you should say to him," and what should you say to him? This is what you should say to the priest. You should say, "I have spoken this day to God your God, because I came to the land which God has sworn to our fathers to give to us." Okay? That verse. Now, before we analyze what's strange in that verse, something very strange, just to, in case you're not familiar with these biblical verses, if you take a look at the next verse, it says the priest takes before the... Okay, fine. So you say before God your God. And what shall you say? And it tells you what to say, that Arami tried to destroy Laban the Aramite, tried to destroy my father, went down to Egypt, etc., etc., the whole story. Then you keep going of the fact that the Jews were in Egypt, that they cried to God, that God saw their pain, and God took us out of Egypt with an outstretched arm. Okay, with a strong hand and outstretched arm and with great miracles, etc. And he brought us, in verse 9, he brought us to this place, and he gave us the land that flows with milk and honey. And now, behold, I bring the fruits of the land which you, God, have given me, and I place it before God, and you should place it, and then you shall bow down before God. You're very happy with the good that God has given you and your house, you and the Levite, which is in your midst. Okay. Now, so we see this. There is a whole system going on here. The fruits must be brought to the priest in the temple, and then there is this verbiage, these statements that must be made by the pilgrim who comes with his first to Jerusalem. Okay. Now let's go back to this verse over here, verse 26, verse 3. Now, there's something that stands out. Actually, there's two things that stand out in that verse, but there's one that I'm thinking of especially. That verse is something very strange. Okay, does anybody want to volunteer what that is, what exactly it is. Anybody? I'd rather give you the opportunity before I point that out.
Okay, we're waiting to see if anybody wants to take a stab. What about that spoke to the Lord, his God?
Okay, good. Yeah, and he's correct, exactly. You see, what is strange over here is like this, that what is he supposed to say? And by the way, this is all, you know, I mean, as you know, this is all formulated in halacha, precisely. In other words, when the pilgrim comes, he must say, he says, you shall come to the Kohen that will be in that generation, and you shall say, this is what he must say. He says, he must say, I have spoken this day to God your God. Now, this is strange. Why is it strange? He's saying, God, your God? If you notice, that's why I went through with you the entire story that he tells. Actually, the word Higgadati, which means I have spoken, is the word Haggadah. You might recognize it. Haggadah means more than just saying. The word to say in Hebrew is Amar. Higgid means when you tell, Higgid means to tell a story. And, of course, he has to go through the whole story over here. And he has to say precise. He can't omit a word. He must say every single word. So he goes through the whole story. And what does he? And what does he say? And he says, take a look at verse 10. In conclusion, and now I brought the fruits of the land which you, God, have given me. Okay. And you should place it before God, your God. All right. Now, and you should bow down before God, your God. What is the purpose of this? Is to show that God is to praise God for all the good that He has done for the pilgrim. The pilgrim must be aware of the good that God has given him. If that is it, so how could his very first statement, that opening statement, is almost a denial of that? He says, "I have spoken today to God, your God." It should have been to God, my God, our God. Oh, what is it, your God? That's exactly, it would seem, of what the Torah is trying to accomplish. The Torah is trying to bring the pilgrim closer to God, to make him appreciate what God has done for him. And here in his very opening statement, he says to the priest, I have a story to tell. I'm going to tell a story before God, your God. Excluding, it would sound like, what does this mean? What kind of meaning is this? I mean, we know, as I said last week, we don't read the Bible. We study the Bible because every word in the Bible contains numerous concepts and ideas, and every word has to be precise. Just gloss over it, and it's not something that's like a human, something that's written by man that's subject to error. This is perfection itself. So how could it be that the Torah says that the pilgrim must say, and this is what the law is, he must say to God, your God. If he says to God, our God, he didn't fulfill the commandments. Okay, there is something else that stands out in that same verse. You see, sometimes when we analyze Torah in the Talmudic method, we look for more questions. Because when we find another question, every question opens up a new avenue. A question isn't just a difficulty. A question is something which opens up channels.
Rabbi?
Yes.
All right.
There's one more thing that's strange in that verse.
Okay. All right. They want you to reread the verse in your translation because yours is different than ours.
Oh, okay.
So
I'm just making up my own translation.
Okay. Well, now, you're not making up an interpretation to go with it, are you?
No. Well, the interpretation...
Okay.
I'm going to bring you the source for, but the translation is
right.
My own. I'll tell you what, read me your translation.
Okay, it says, and thou shalt go unto the priest,
right,
who shall be in those days,
right,
and say unto him, I profess this day, that's literally confess this day, unto the Lord thy God.
No, confess not. Now, the word is, it comes from Haggadah, Higgadati. Haggadah means to tell a story.
Tell a story. Yeah, got it. Yeah, okay.
That's just like that gutter on Passover.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, this very chapter, by the way, is used in the Haggadah. Okay, good.
All right. I am come unto the country which the Lord, that's the Tetragrammaton, swore unto our fathers to give us.
Exactly.
All right.
Did I say it differently?
You changed it a little bit.
I confess this again. I confess this day. What does it say after that?
It said, the God, your God,
is
the...
Exactly. Okay.
the Lord thy God. It's the Lord your God. It's the same meaning.
Same meaning.
All right, then Jim Long had a statement. What was yours? All right, he said that you're using this as a pilgrim in the land.
Oh, the pilgrim, yeah, I mean to say the pilgrimage, because wherever he is...
It's a pilgrimage. He's not a he can be in the land, but he's making a pilgrimage from Nazareth or Tiberias or Beersheba.
Right.
Okay. All right, so we got that cleared. Thank you.
Okay. Sure.
Wait a minute, hold on, we got one more. All right, Gary Cannon, and he's going to come around and ask the question also. Okay, here's Gary.
Rabbi, you mentioned that... he's changing around here. You mentioned that the person didn't identify as God being his God, but it appears that he does identify with him when he uses the word us there at the end of that verse.
That's correct. Yes. Okay. That is true. But we still have to understand why he didn't say in the first place, God, our God.
Mm-hmm.
Why does he say God, your God? So that still remains a question. You are right. There's no question. When you read the verses that follow again, all the verses, it's clear that he thinks God is God. But yet you still have that discrepancy over here where he says to the priest, God, your God.
Okay.
Okay.
Now you're looking for a second thing in the text.
Now I said that the way when we analyze the Talmudic method, we look for other questions. Another problem in this text. Okay. Not as blatant as the first one. The first one, it's a little more difficult to catch this one. And the principle is that there are no extra words or expressions in the Bible. That God is very economical. He doesn't waste words. So, as a matter of fact, in the Bible we say that one verse can contain many concepts, but the opposite is impossible. To say that two verses contain one concept is an impossibility. So God is very economical in his Bible, and every word counts. There's nothing extra. Now there is something extra in this verse. Can anyone pick it out? There's something extra there that is not necessary. Not necessary. Which, as a matter of fact, is a little absurd. Okay. Hello? Are we on?
Okay.
Okay.
All right, Jim Long.
If anybody wants to take a stab at it, okay. If not, I'll...
Jim Long.
Go ahead.
He's entered the land that the Lord gave to their fathers.
All right. Jim said that I am come unto the land which the Lord swore unto our fathers to give us.
No, that's necessary. The reason why he's saying that is because what he's trying to say is he's trying to express humility, that the land is not mine because I deserve it. Because God swore to my forefathers that that their seed will inherit. It was because of them, not because of me. It's not because of my virtue. It's their virtue that planned. If it weren't for them, I wouldn't have anything. So he's being humble in his expression over here. He's not saying that he's special because he has the land. He deserves the land. He doesn't deserve anything. It happens to be that Abraham is a righteous man, and God swore to Abraham that his father Abraham, not because of him. That's why he says that. But it's a good observation. I mean, why it was necessary to say that? That was a good point. But there's something else in this verse which is really a little bit absurd, actually.
I would say that it's to say unto him, and I say this day. You got a repetitive phrase.
Well, see, there are two things. One is instruction. It's telling him what to do. You should say to him, say what? Okay? Quote. And this is the quote that he has.
That's it. Okay. All right.
Okay. What's strange is the very beginning of the passage, of the verse, because the verse says you should come to the priest that will be in those days. Well, of course. I mean, how is it possible to come to a priest that exists in other days? Anytime you go to someone, he has to exist in your days. If he doesn't exist in a race, you can't see him. You can't go to the Aaron the priest. Aaron the priest passed away. You can't go to any other priest of past generations. You must go to the priest that's in your generation, in those days. So this is simply extra. All it had to say was, and you should go to the priest, say to him, We have many times in Leviticus, for instance, where it says that you should go to the priest. Once you go to the word priest, if it's possible, I'll use the word Kohen instead, okay? Because the word priest always has a connotation of, religious practices and rites, and Torah doesn't have, because we only have halacha. So if it's okay with everyone, I'll use the word Kohen from now on. So it says in Leviticus many times that you should come to the Kohen to show him the leprosy. He has to pronounce it. It doesn't say, okay, Kohen, that's in your generation. This is redundant. Okay? And there is no redundant principles of Torah. There's no redundancy in Torah. So Rashi, of course, the great commentary, immediately explains this. He says like this. He says that you must have respect for the Kohen in your generation, just like any Kohen in any other generation. Okay? Which means to say that the Kohen that is in your generation is not inferior to the Kohen in any other generation. Now, we have the same, all right? You have the same problem before in, just give me a moment. It's in Deuteronomy. We don't have to take out another book. It's Deuteronomy 17:9. Am I right? 17:9? And it says, you should priests and the Levites, and to the judge that will be, okay? Am I right? Deuteronomy 17:9, right? Okay? So over here, the rabbis say, ask the same question. They say, well, what does it mean? You should come to the judge that's in your generation, in those days. Of course, can't come to previous generations. So the rabbis say, the Talmudic scholars say that this is something, to teach you something. It means to say you must respect the scholars in your generation, even if they are not as great as the scholars in the previous generation. You must have the same veneration for them that you for a Samuel, all right? The greatest teacher, for a Moses. You must have the same. In other words, the rabbis say, Jephthah, in his generation is as great as the Samuel. In his generation, you must, even with Jephthah, was not as great as Samuel, but you must respect him as much as you would respect the Samuel. Why? Which means to say like this, that you must subordinate yourself to the authority of the generation, to the man who has the knowledge in your generation. And you can't have knowledge as previous generations. Could be it doesn't. You may be right. But the fact is, you must follow the greatest knowledge that's available to you. And you must treat that knowledge as if it's absolute, because that's the best you have. And you cannot be derogatory towards a teacher, a judge, a member of the Sanhedrin, if he isn't as great a scholar as the scholars of previous generations. Because he is in charge, he is the authority, God entrusts the Torah to him because of his knowledge, and you must respect that man as if he were the greatest scholar. Okay? So there we have the same problem, and the answer of the rabbis. He says the same thing over here. He says, over here it's trying to teach you that the idea is that the Kohen, the priest, or you must also treat him, no matter, even if he isn't as great as the previous ones, you must treat him as if he was just as great. Now, this is the question. He says, I don't understand, he says. He says, a judge, I could say, you know, there were superior judges, greater people than I have today, so I have the problem. But a Kohen is the same, he is the same Kohen. I mean, there's no, you can't be a superior Kohen. All you have to do to be born, to be a Kohen is to be born from a family that mother is a Kohen. Okay, so there's not much to do. I mean, you are born a Kohen. A Kohen, you cannot become a Kohen. A scholar, the institution of scholarship is totally dependent on the individual. It doesn't matter where he is, what he is. A person who's not permitted to, he could be a bastard. He could be a person, a mamzer, a person that's not permitted to come into, to intermarry into the congregation of Israel. But he could still be the greatest scholar in his generation. There it's totally democratic. Okay? So, all right? But the, so I could say a great scholar, but the, but you cannot say, a better Kohen. How could you say a better Kohen priest or an inferior priest? This is just a matter of birthright. Is he born a Kohen? That's Nachmanides raised this question on Rashi. I believe the answer is what Rashi means is as follows. There is another verse in the Torah where it speaks about the tribe of Levi. All right. The tribe of Levi, when Moses blesses the tribes at the end of his life, okay, before he died, says, this is Deuteronomy 33:10, and here it's speaking about the 33:8, tells you, and he spoke to Levi, says, teach your laws to Jacob and your Torah to Israel, okay, and they place the in your nostrils and the sacrifices on your altars. Okay, it means that they they're the ones that do the they do both. You see, they teach the Torah and they also are the ones that bring the offerings in the temple. Okay, now the all right now. It's an interesting thing, but what does this mean? Why we said that knowledge is democratic. You don't have to have any specific birthright. The person is a no matter what his birthright is, he can still be the greatest scholar, and people will respect him for it and come to him for knowledge. But he's actually the tribe of Levi was designated to be free to in order to study Torah. In a society, everybody free. People have to work. There are economic responsibilities. But it is possible to free a segment of the population so that that segment of the population can devote their time, have the ability to devote their time to knowledge. You can't force them to do it. Okay, nobody ever forced them to sit and study. But the Torah did was it gave one segment of the population, it gave them the obligation to work in the temple, which really wasn't much, actually. It came out about 2 weeks out of the year, maybe a little more, but not much more than that. So the Kohen, free man. So the Kohen was really the one that had the opportunity to study Torah, and on they did. And they were really designated. That was their purpose. Their designation was to be teachers and scholars as well as serving in the temple. And this combination, you see, is in Deuteronomy 33:10, it's placed in the same verse. The fact that they teach and the fact that they're the ones that are in charge of bringing the sacrifices. No one else is permitted to do so. You remember that was the story with the rebellion of Korach, where he decided that it should be Democrat who brings the sacrifices. And the Torah describes the catastrophe that resulted from that view. Okay, now let us get back to the problems we have in Deuteronomy 26:3. Question was to God your God, and why it says to the Kohen that were your days. All right. So the question is, so Rashi says that you must treat each Kohen with the same respect. So Nachmanides says, of course, every Kohen, you can't have an inferior Kohen, either is a Kohen or is not. But what I am pointing to is the fact that, you see, the Kohen was really designated to be not just the one that serves in the temple, but to be the teacher, because he has the time, and therefore what God did was he freed a segment of the population so that they can actually be designated to be teachers. What we're referring to over here is not the Kohen insofar as he serves in the temple, but the Kohen insofar as he is a scholar and a teacher. Now, what does this mean? Why does he say, now we can understand what it means when he says, I have a story to say today before means by God your God is that the individual, this person who made the pilgrimage, when he brings the first fruit, what he has, the first thing he must say is, he must admit to the fact that he does not have the knowledge of that the scholar has. And that's why he says to the Kohen, he says, God, your God. The Kohen is the one who represents scholarship. He's the representative, as it says in Deuteronomy 33:10. They teach your to Jacob and your Torah to Israel. On the whole, they were the main teachers. The Kohen is used in several places in Tanakh to indicate a teacher. It says, the lips of the Kohen guard knowledge. The Kohen is used as to indicate a person who is very knowledgeable. So what Rashi is explaining is like this. The first thing he must admit is the fact that the one that has true knowledge of God is not himself, the Kohen, the learned man. He knows. He has knowledge of God. I don't have that knowledge. Okay? So he's not speaking to this Kohen in particular. It's the concept to the general, to the tribe of the Kohanim, the statement is a reference to. It means the ones that have knowledge of God are the ones that are the scholars. And that's why Rashi says that you must respect the Kohen in your generation, even if the scholarship is not as great. So you'll say, well, why should I say that I don't have the knowledge of God? Is God your God? You're the one that has more knowledge, that has the knowledge of God. I don't have that knowledge. Why do I have to make that admission to this group of priests? Maybe years ago I would say, if there were other, they had great scholars, but today I don't feel like doing that. The Torah says, you have to treat him in your generation as if he were the greatest. You have no right to. You can't distinguish, because the general idea is since in general he has the Kohen is the one that's dedicated to knowledge.
Rabbi.
Yes.
We got to turn the tape.
Okay.
And you'll have to say the Kohen is.